Thank you very much, Kim Chairperson. Thank you to the members for the questions that were posed. I'm going to deal with questions in the order that they were asked. And I'm going to start, therefore, with Honourable Atkinson's question. The budget cuts for 2016-17 is principally in goods and services. From 2017-18, for 2 years, it will be concentrated in both staffing and goods and services. And I think there's really a challenge, but a good challenge on the department to be more efficient. My experience in government has been that when the pressure is put, somehow departments find ways to get the work done more efficiently, using resources more cleverly. So I'm not troubled by the cut. I think at a macro level, it's well motivated. You need to do this, but again, the public finances on a sustainable path, and EDD's contribution, I think, can be in a few areas. The one is in better efficiencies. Instead of having a conference at the hotel in this period, it may make good sense to find a public entity with an available auditorium and do those kind of things. But the second part is to extract more value from the public sector. The public sector is an incredibly well-resourced sector, but an underutilized sector. So you have people all over reinventing wheels. And sometimes it's unglamorous to find a piece of work that's already been done and to give it some publicity when it's more glamorous to reinvent the wheel. But if we are faced with the fiscal challenges that we are faced, I think it forces us to do what we should in any event do. So sometimes these times force to work in the way that a well-designed public sector should in any event be working. So I think the message I give EDD is I'm not going to be a lobbyist for the department to get more funding. I want them to do more with less resources. I'm going to hold back on the Lorenzo's question because I think I may be able to respond to it in a few minutes' time. Honourable Matsinga, the questions you asked on the Polish transaction that has been referred to in the document. We've approved the transaction. They've now completed the engineering design. And if there are no delays, we hope construction of the project can start within 6 months, and it will be in the Island IDZ area. So hopefully this is quite fast by the sense of the state. So I hold cross fingers, and we'll try to do the more technical work so that we don't rely on cross fingers to make sure that we do this as quickly as possible. On the NARICEC question, I will try to get some more details on the provinces that are affected by this, and the progress we found when we did these visits were that as people graduated from NARICEC, so all NARICEC training program, as they graduated and they began to set up their own operations or cooperatives, they often hit problems that they found insurmountable. And because nobody does significant aftercare support, post-training support, you have a good program yielding weak results. So this site visit was in fact precisely to identify this problem and see how to solve it. So I think we've done reasonably well. So maybe what we could do is in a quarter or so's time we can track how these co-ops are doing. Maybe the challenge is because you can do lots of little visits like this, but they drop in an ocean. So can we change the mindset in the public sector that is less transactional and more strategic? And I think that's really a hard issue. And let me illustrate this in this way. Departments across the board are staffed with people with a range of skills. But in many cases, individuals only see, we've got to get this room ready for the peace, for the portfolio committee. Someone will think their job is to sit on the light. The fact that the projector doesn't work isn't within their remit. But I've done my job. I can tick that box. I can report my KPI has been achieved. So it's to get an integrated idea where people don't think only how to get their mandate sorted, but how to get impact. You only train people because you want them to have jobs or to run businesses. So I think we're picking up that problem. But the thing with Carol Beef and other show, which I think was quite helpful, is that there is an appetite within the private sector to help smaller players, particularly when you can show a commercial advantage to the large company. That's how companies think, and we need to connect need by a smaller player with opportunity by a larger company to deepen their supply chain. So Karen Beef is doing this. I think it's a good thing, but they will benefit from it, and that's good for us too. I don't think we've got that one cut yet, how to take that lesson from Marisek and do it on a wide scale. We don't have the institutions focused on that at the moment. I would hope that that's one of the things that EDD could do, is to get CEDA, which is a small enterprise development agency, which falls under small business development, to look at regular site visits to people coming off the Marisek program who have entered into co-ops or small businesses, just to see what technical support do they need, exactly what we stumbled on here in the site visit. So I think you've raised an important point for which I don't think we have a structural solution yet. Maybe that's a little bit of work, Deputy Minister, that we can try to get done. How can we get post-training support on the NARISEC program? The rural development will feel they've done their job, but often there are these challenges. On the drought issues that has been raised, directly in EDD, one of our agencies, the IDC, has made available approximately 400 million rand for the figure correctly, subject to confirmation of the figure. I've done the sum and we reported it in Sona debate of what the rural development, DAF, EDD and the land bankers put together by way of draft support, and it was just short of a billion rand. To that should be added the monies that water and sanitation has made available, the infrastructure level, and then of course additional support the Minister Gordon mentioned in the budget that we're putting together. I think the draft issue is going to be critical, so I want to jump to on the Pikinini's question on the use of seawater. To convert seawater to usable water, you basically got to reduce or remove the salt content. If you use it for industrial purposes, you've got to reduce. If you want to make it potable where you can drink it, you basically got to remove virtually all the salt. To do that, there is quite a number of technologies to do that. But they're very energy intensive. They use a lot of heat, and that makes it expensive. So the water is available, but at a much higher price than the economic price that the farmer can pay in order to store, have their products available at reasonable prices. So the Chinese have invested most heavily globally on desalination technologies, that's what it's called. And we think, just like 8-9 years ago, the big investment was in the renewable energy, in solar panels, in the new technologies around concentrated solar power, so on. Then it seems to us that in the next 10-15 years, the big R&D globally is going to go into desalination. And so hopefully the cost will come down quite significantly. If there's an appetite in the committee, wanting to load too much additional work on it, but if there is an appetite, maybe one of the things we can look at is a focus session on desalination and economic development. What's cost gaps? Where do we do it? There's some work on desalination in Saldanha at the moment. There's some work that was going to be done in desalination if we need an oil refinery in Nelson Mandela Bay and so on. So maybe a little bit piece of work on what are the desalination projects in the country, what is the research, if any, that the CSIR is conducting on it, and you can bring that to the committee. But you must indicate if you think there's a piece of work that's worth doing, because it's not on our APPs at the moment, we can then put it into the APP as a product that we produce. Then coming back to the question that Honourable Matsimbe asked about financial support for the township economy, it illustrates me the same challenge that I had with Medicare, which is the state does things in pieces, not in an integrated bit. So it will do one thing, but not necessarily see the connection. We're beginning to get this right in a number of cases. So there's more integrated support now offered, for example, when we have an SEZ, or when we have a presidential node, or when we have a strategic integrated project on infrastructure. So I think it's to take those lessons. So what I can do is we will come back on KPI 16. Maybe we can do it in the quarter 3 report, just to indicate whether that includes financial support, and if not, is something one can do there. Little beginning, I've dealt with the vacancies issue a bit indirectly when I responded to Honourable Atkinson's question, but let me just add, and I was smiling when you made the point, which is a astute point, and I'm glad it's been made positively and not by whipping the department. It's a good point that with fewer resources, we're getting our job done, we're getting even more than our job done. And the question is, how are we doing that? And a lot of it is smart resource application. In other words, instead of relying on 6 or 7 people to reinvent the wheel, we know we've got an expert in the IDC. We bring that expert to be available for the department. If we know that there's someone in ESCOM that is excellent, we don't have to get a mid-level official in the department to do work that even after 2 months' work will still be less than the knowledge level of a senior person in ESCOM. We get that information, we lock it in. So it's a much smarter use of management techniques and support than is traditionally done by departments. And we've referred to that in our annual report, that we are trying to create more of a smart way of delivering, which is not as labor intensive, where someone must write up something of which the knowledge already exists there. It's trying to tap into it. So well spotted, I could say, on that point. On the secondments issue, our program with UJ, where we're seconding staff from UJ to be available through the MOU, is proceeding well. We're getting high-level people, so we can now get engineers, qualified engineers that are teaching in the engineering faculty at UJ. And these are people that we typically can't afford with the public sector salaries, where they'll come in at the director level or even at the chief director level. But we can bring them in because now they do part-time work for EDD and they are retained also on the books of UJ to do the lecturing. We benefit because they often bring higher level expertise, as I've indicated. UJ benefits because it's a public institution. It now knows what are real life problems in engineering. Not the textbook challenges only, but also in reality when you do a project, what goes wrong. So hopefully the teaching experience will also be enriched. We've now expanded that to Wits University, and it's still early days to evaluate that. So it's moving a bit slow with Wits, but I think we're going to get there. As we get this right, I'm not suggesting this is something that can apply across the board in the sec, but it's a really innovative approach, and it's in a public sector whose culture doesn't like innovation, and where departments build ever bigger budgets and ever bigger staff so that they can have more role for themselves. And the question is whether one can succeed in persuading more of the public sector that you don't need to build these massive empires to be effective. You can do it through smart use of resources. You can do it. So it's what I said to Honourable Atkinson. I think both members have zoomed in on exactly what, from my experience, is going to be needed more and more in the future. And I think sometimes the resource constraint is an advantage. It means that you can't do things in the old ways. You've got to do new things in new, more cost-effective ways, and the taxpayer benefits and the public benefits. But obviously, there are vested interests, and vested interests will protest and will say, don't do it in that way. So it's important that we also explain what we're trying to do and showcase positive examples. Honorable Cardo asked a question on the employment tax incentive, and Treasury will be making an announcement on that, and I think the announcement will indicate an extension, but I don't want to obviously take over the role of a colleague on that. I think, Honorable Cardo, the big challenge for us is not having an incentive. I think everybody agrees that one needs to have an incentive. The real issue is, how do you design an incentive that it genuinely creates new employment, that companies don't game system, and simply that any company normally has a churn factor, natural attrition, people retire, they resign, they get bored at the medical, and so on. And if you game the system and you now employ people that you would in any event have employed, but you get an incentive, then the state don't create new employment. And remember, because resources are scarce, our key thing is how many new jobs are we creating. And a new job is not a new person who's employed. A new job is a job that would not otherwise have been created. And so it's that's the challenge. So and I think Treasury is committed to that, Cabinet is committed to that. It's how to review, tweak, make sure that our incentive actually creates that additional job. So that's really what the whole thing is about. And what we need to get more right. So I think Treasury wants to do a detailed review so that we can see what are the lessons from the early phase of this. On KPI 4, the scrap metal policy, now I want to differentiate between two initiatives that are completely separate. The first initiative is a localization program to try to reduce the export of scrap metal that defies local foundries of feedstock. And that has been the motivation for the price preference regime that we've put in place. So let me talk about that first, and then I'll come to the second one. Now, we've seen a decline in the export of scrap metal, at least in the declared value of scrap metal. We've interacted with industry. Industry has indicated that they believe that more needs to be done, that the exporters, the scrap metal merchants, are not significantly accepting the spirit of the regulations, and they're trying to find ways to bypass it. Now, that's an opinion. So we're testing that. We're looking at whether that's valid or not. As I say, if you just look purely at the trade data, it tells a fairly positive story from a localization point of view. Separate to that is an initiative by the DICC to reduce theft of scrap metal in the National Infrastructure Program. And there, the problem is well known, I think, to members. It was debated in Parliament. Take the Western Cape as an example. If you look at metro numbers for PRASA in the Western Cape, Cape Town, quite interestingly and worryingly, the numbers are actually declining. And yet, the number of commuters are growing. And the reason is very simple. There are days, and Premier Zille has been quite clear about this in her discussions at the PICC, when the train can't run in Cape Town because cable has been stolen. Minister Mokonyane tells me that water supplies in Gauteng, and people think it was poor planning, instead of it being poor planning and drought, it's often that pipes are stolen and the water is not able to move to local communities. The Gautrain, commuters in Gautrain very often are affected by that. Schools are vandalized. Eskom power stations, substations, transformers, and the lines themselves are often stolen. So what we've done is we've done a few things. One is Parliament passed in record time last year the Criminal Matters Amendment Act. And that sets a number of quite tough conditions. It creates a new category of crime. It makes it tougher to have bail. It sets minimum sentencing. So it's taken quite a tough stance there. But that's not sufficient. So there's a second set of things, which is to better monitor trade, the domestic trade in scrap metal. And the police are coming in. We're looking at what changes are required to the Second Hand Goods Act, but also better policing, better enforcement. One of the ideas is, can we get more local law enforcement officers playing a role in managing and monitoring theft of metal and cable? But on the export side, because we have such a lucrative export trade, it creates a market. And unfortunately, part of that market is satisfied by the theft of cable and metal. So ITAC has been given the responsibility to look at what export controls need to be put in place to reduce that market. So we're trying to deal both on the domestic market and on the export market with lowering the incentives that's available. It's like, if you think of drugs, the more money in drugs, the more illegality will be fostered, the more desperate people become, the more blatant they become about their attempts to set up little drug producing operations. And so, using the same logic that you want to try to reduce the margin that's available in order to stop what can be a potentially life-threatening damage to public infrastructure. I mean, when a hospital is dark because its electricity has been cut because of theft of cable feed. The other day, one of my old staff, 2 days ago, working on something, sent me a message saying he will be offline on his cell phone because there's been cable theft to his house. It's affecting at the micro level, it's affecting at the macro level. So we will look obviously at the impact of tighter regulation, tighter logistics. If you have one single port of exit, you can have much better controls. You can have your metallurgic engineers there to see whether the declared scrap metal is in fact what is on the necessary papers. You don't have the resources in the state to spread your scarce technical capability across all your ports. So we've got to do all of this. We've got to do it that is not so intrusive. It's got to be the minimum harm for the maximum gain. But it can't be business as usual, unfortunately. If we don't deal with this issue, we're not going to bring an end to the theft of metal and cable. So we will have some concerns from the private sector. We've got to evaluate their concerns. But to change things, unfortunately, there has to be adjustment and some degree of pain in that. So we will look at that. ITAC published their proposals, they had feedback. They'll be considering that feedback now. On the steel industry and the company that the IEC has worked with on the pre-feasibility study, the pre-feasibility study itself was concluded in December last year, and the report was submitted in January. And the study indicated that the issues that will make a new steel mill successful would include two markets, location, price of raw materials, and so on. They looked at some numbers, what would be the optimum capacity of a steel mill, and they wanted additional work done on logistics and sourcing of raw material. Now that's the technical answer. If I step back on the technical answer, I look at the overall thing. When there's a surplus of steel in the domestic market, why are we looking at additional capacity? And the reason is that obviously government can't only plan for the bottom end of a commodity cycle. We've got to look at the full life cycle. And when demand picks up, and at the moment we've got an enormous glut of steel on global markets, when that glut is removed, and the glut is typically removed by enterprises closing, so you've got to reduce supply or you've got to increase demand. China's looking now at reducing the number of steel mills. There's already been closures in the UK. Tata Steel closed quite a lot of their steel operations. There's been big protests. We saw the big protests in France. There's been a big issue in the United States around schools. It's not yet played a big role in the primaries. Let's see what happens when they get to Ohio. So I think unquestionably companies and countries are looking at reducing supply. South Africa needs to look at when demand picks up again. Can we be well positioned then to have transformation of our iron ore to create jobs here? But there's a second reason, and the second reason is a quite important one for us. In certain kinds of steel products, we've got a single player, one producer. That means we have no competition on the domestic market. The only competition comes from imports. And when a company, a public enterprise or a private enterprise buys steel from abroad because the local supplier quality is bad or price is too high or the type of steel is not available, we fail to create a job in South Africa. So that's why we've got to look at this. A steel mill is not built overnight. This is a project that will be a number of years before we even get to the point where the first steel is produced. And at that stage, it will be viable only if the market has shifted dramatically. Now, let's come to where we are with this particular transaction. Obviously, it's commercially sensitive. So within that, I want to make one or two broader remarks. We're picking up that China is cutting its own steel production. So we're anticipating China's appetite for rapid expansion of new steel mills elsewhere in the world is getting lower. So we've got to factor that in. So the discussions with this company is continuing, but I have no doubt that they would probably want to reset their time frames. It's in our interest to do it as quickly as possible. It's in their interest to wait for the market to stabilize. They're only going to do this if it's commercially viable. So that's the ding-dong, if you like, that we'll be pursuing in the period ahead. If we get it done too quickly, the investor lose and we lose because there'll be too much steel. If we don't do it, we'll always be in a situation where only one dominant player upstream. And that dominant player can set the price. And that's not good. Competition helps to keep companies on their toes, and in fact a number of studies have called for more aggressive competition in the upstream steel market. On the sustainability of the National Infrastructure Investment Envelope, well, one of the most significant announcements made by Minister Gordhan was the infrastructure number. And he made quite a telling comment. He said that the state is seeking to maintain the general level of infrastructure spend, even though the composition of it will change. Now, a big part of our infrastructure in the past was based on the market projections of Transnet. So the big port expansions, the rail lines, the freight capability like locomotives and wagons, all of that is a big part of infrastructure development. The market is collapsing. Global demand for South African iron ore, manganese, platinum, and to some extent coal, as we use. So we've worked over the last 9 months very actively with Treasury, with state-owned companies, and with other departments to find other projects that were going slow and that we were prepared to accept their relatively slow pace because our overall targets were being met, and we're now trying to move that faster. So some of it would be the water space. So we're trying to move dams more quickly off the starting line. And others are on a much more diversified array of energy projects. So therefore, the coal IPP that was announced, we're trying to get private sector investment in coal energy to try to move that more quickly, given Eskom's challenges. So I'm certainly making the argument why we need to sustain a high level of infrastructure spending. Treasury supports that argument very strongly, very robustly. And the question then is, when you've got fiscal pressures, where will you save the money? So if you say, don't touch infrastructure, what do you touch? And that's what, in a sense, my colleague's speech was about. And it was a speech that indicated we've got to cut down on consumption spending, and we've got to look at the overall South Pole in the state so that we have resources for investment and we have resources for the minimum social grants that the poor must have. We don't want to touch the basic support that the state provides poor South Africans, and we don't want to touch the investment in our own wealth creation, that's infrastructure investment. We've got a way to go before we get to 10% of GDP. Our big challenge in this budget was to avoid a massive reduction in infrastructure spending. I did some numbers. We met with Transnet. With market demand changes, it was a real fear that we were going to have a big hole in our infrastructure spending. We've been able to plug that with a more diversified set of projects. So that, I'm hopeful, will be more sustainable. But it remains an area we're going to keep an eye on. So one of the more valued reports that CICC brings to Cabinet is the report on spending, because that shows where the holes are opening and what we need to do to try to beef up spending. If we get 10% of GDP, you can have a real surge in growth. But to get there is a challenge, because with debt levels where they are, the state don't want to significantly increase its debt. So we're looking at more innovative things. Renewable energy was an innovative way. We pay a bit more than we should have for the first two windows, but we also managed to attract fresh investment into the economy. I've given a bit of additional detail, because one of the numbers we want to keep an eye on constantly is the infrastructure spend. Honourable Tiani, thank you for the warm comments that were made. On the companies that the IDC supported, the one in particular in Mpumalanga has 1,800 people employed. But I should say that whilst we did quite a bit of work in quarter two and in quarter three, we're still battling at the moment. So you're saving the company is like a patient, that you're keeping the patient alive, but you need to change something in the lifestyle of the patient. You can't just keep the patient alive on education. The thing that we need is a investor with knowledge of steel industry and with relatively deep pockets. Anglo owned that company and, in our view, underinvested in the latter years. They then sold it to a Russian investor, Everest Steel. In my view, they underinvested. And this is abundant evidence of that in the competitiveness of the steel mill. And we're now sitting looking for a third suitor for this company. And the international investor that we attracted is concerned at the some liabilities that the company has, including liabilities on environmental issues. So that hasn't been resolved. But also the company itself, the Chinese company, is worried about the clutter in global markets. So it's exactly what I've raised earlier as the challenge when I spoke to the question raised by Honorable Cardo. We're trying to keep all bits of our steel industry intact, but the pressures are enormous. Fund investors, and we need them, they've got the know-how. It's not the capital only that they'll bring. See, the IDC can't run a steel mill. It's a bank. It's a development bank. It's not an industrialist. So it's got to find an industrialist who knows technology, who knows the work processes, the quality of the ores, how to blend them, where the markets are, what the new products are. And those kind of people are shy at the moment. They're holding back. They're saying all their investments elsewhere in the world is bleeding. They're shy now. So that's the challenge. We're so hopeful, but it's a tough battle at the moment to keep that plant open. On the support for the cooperatives, whether the training took place in November, I'm not sure if the department knows that, but we can certainly report that in the next quarterly report, which I think will be imminent in the next week or 2 weeks or 3 weeks. As soon as that report comes, we will report on that. On the vaccination of cattle, taking the project to other areas, thank you for the suggestion, Honourable Kenny. We ask the department to follow that up with rural development and agriculture, and then we can come back and say what new initiatives can we do on the same issue. Honourable, Taylor's question on making black industrialists broad-based. The policy document that the DTI has issued says it must be broad-based. So that's the simple answer. But as we know, these things are, it's easier to write something on a piece of paper than to implement it. So I think we're in for a rough period with shifting from one model of BEE to another model. The very first model of BEE was very individually based, and it was based on shareholding, taking a percentage shareholding in a company owned by others. The next development was to make it broad-based and to still make it shareholder-focused. The black industrialist takes it to a third phase, which says, get black South Africans into production itself, not into taking a share in a company that someone else runs, but set up a company, buy a company, expand your own company if you've got a successful operation. So this is a much more difficult phase to get right. And money is not going to be the problem. The IDC said, we've got the money. But the IDC can't waste the money. In other words, can't put it into a project that will lose billions. You've got to put it into something that will break even and grow over time. So I think the caution you put in is important now to make sure it's broad-based. It's an area we need to keep on focusing. But at the same time, we want some success stories of, even if we start off with individual entrepreneurs, or black entrepreneurs who are making competitively priced products, we're going to talk that up, we're going to show the advantage of it, and we're going to work with them to see how can they bring their workers and communities and young people into their supply chains and into their equity arrangements. Honorable Ransom's question on the heat map earlier, I thought when she asked the question she was asking about the heat map against the AG findings, and I the question she asked is it possible for the department to get to an unqualified audit with no findings, what is sometimes called a clean audit? Or are we so affected by the fact that we work with other departments? And no, frankly, it is possible for the department to get to that. There's no bar to that. It's just the management must put the systems in place and monitor the systems and make sure that they work. So I don't think there's any excuse that the department can give because it integrates the work of others. That may affect some KPIs, but it doesn't affect the internal operations of finance. So I don't accept that as a valid reason if the department gives it. On the time frames to get there, perhaps what we'd be looking for is, I would hope that the current audit would give me an insight in how well EDD has improved its systems. The acting DG was brought in specifically because of the systems knowledge that he's had to try to see can we stabilize the internal processes in EDD, while the ministry focuses much more on policy work and on promoting investment. So I'm looking forward, in fact, it will be quite interesting for me to see the AG's report and see how close are we to an audit without any findings. I think after that, perhaps, we can come back and set a target. Hopefully we achieve it now. If we don't achieve it now, there can't be a reason why it shouldn't be in the next financial year then. I think we've got to be tougher about that. It is a compliance issue. It only measures that, you know, we're getting our accounting right and our systems right, but that's important. I'm obviously Deputy Minister, and I am much more focused on the outcomes and the impact of our work, and the DG is much more focused on the internal staff management, finance management, and so on. So we will certainly, he is here and he's hearing the concerns that's been raised. So, Chairperson, Acting Chairperson, I think that covers the questions that were asked, and there were two of the questions we will come back with answers in the next quarterly report.
Let me welcome the DM, Honorable Masuku, and the Chairperson of the committee, Mrs. Coleman. Let's go to the second round and the last one. Honorable Atkinson.
Thanks very much, Chair. Thank you, Minister, for your answers. You were referring to the change in the nature of the spending on infrastructure. You mentioned the fact that water would be one of the focuses and the building dams. I do remember at the beginning of the session that you were telling us about the dam. I think it was the Amzunguru River, which was going to assist with small scale commercial agriculture from what was a leather sending area. I was just wondering what the progress has been made on that dam and where are we with that? Thanks.
I'm looking at you, my chairperson. Let me give the minister to respond, Mr. Epperson.
Thank you very much. I should just, before answering Honourable Atkinson, on the question that was asked earlier by Honourable Matsimbi on the Narisek, the staff has advised me that all the Narisek co-ops are in the Sedibeng municipality. So that answers the question on their location. The ones that we visited, so that was all in Sedibeng. Honourable Atkinson, there's been considerable progress. We've got a construction start date that has been given to Cabinet. I'm going to talk to my colleague, when can we make a public announcement, whether she wishes to do it in her budget vote, whether we certain enough for me to do it in our budget vote, but we've got a date now, and let me put it this way, it is not as long into the future as the previous state was. We a lot more technical work has been done. Now some concerns have come up about the how we're going to do it, that we engage in the Department for Water and Sanitation, and I hope we can do that without slowing down the indicative data they've given us. Where I suspect more work needs to be done is what happens post the building of the dam. What support packages will rural development and death bring to small-scale farmers? Because in many cases there you've got absolute subsistence farming. If you've been in that part of the Eastern Cape, you'll know that there are many villages where it is currently that the land is used in a very minimalist way. And to try to change that, you need to bring in a whole bunch of things, you know, support around fertilizers, vaccination, new seeds development, how to deal with droughts and frost, how to deal with all the challenges of moving people from subsistence farming to commercial farming that's predictable, where markets have demands. You can't sell a product for 3 months and then for the next 2 years you're unable to supply, you lose your order. So it's trying to change to improve business skills of the small farmers and so on. That's quite a big thing. So we've got a couple of years to get that right, because the dam will take some years to build, but I suspect that that's the area that we need to put more effort in now, so that we don't, as government, begin to do that work when the dam is virtually complete. And it's been a very important lesson around the Dubuque Dam, because national government focused on our constitutional competence, which is to build the dam. We left to the municipalities the reticulation of the water, and there's been problem after problem in that municipality in getting its act together. Now, you have done because it's a constitutionally protected right at that level of order, that sphere of government has, but in the end of the day, all our investment in the dam comes to naught if someone can't turn in a tap in Jane first and have water coming out of the tap. So the same with the development in Msimfobo, that we've got to get that back piece of work done. And as soon as we're confident that the announcement can be made on Zimbabwe, I think we'll get the team working on that. By the way, I should say, this is a storyline that we need to tell much more powerfully publicly when we've got all our ducks in a row. If we can get the dam built and the N2 rerouted from East London to Durban, which would cut up to 3 hours of travel time, particularly for the trucks, which would then increase intra-provincial traffic, which will bring rural health states into national markets, because at the moment trying to sell your products and sending it to urban just takes too long, logistics and so on. So if we can get that right, and we can get Mthatha's revitalization program completed, then you've got a critical mass of infrastructure interventions in that area that can begin to change it. In this school book program, one of our real successes has been in the eastern part of the Eastern Cape, building rural schools in the remote areas. The other day I went to on a road to Hole in the Wall, and we opened a new school there, and it was an absolutely remote rural area where people have been using, or kids have been using, a lot of school. So it's when, you know, the dam on its own is not going to change things. Getting all of these other things right, the farming support, the roads, the storage facilities, so you need agriculture infrastructure in that area over and above the dam. You need the irrigation, the canals and so on. So all of that will be the next phase of our work. Thank you.
I don't think there are any further issues to discuss. If not, can I then take the opportunity to put on the department, if the honourable members, supporting staff, and PMG for the deliberations that we engaged today. They were the worst ones. Thanks very much. The meeting stands adjourned.